Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hi, this is Jay Richards with the Discovery Institute. Thanks for joining us again on this episode of Intelligent Design the Future. I am joined again by science historian and friend Mike Keyes, and he's back to talk with us about this Cosmos series called Cosmos Possible Worlds, which is really the sort of third incarnation of the Cosmos series. The first one, of course, is the famous PBS series with the late astronomer Carl Sagan in 1980. And then in 2014, there was a major series with astronomer Neil deGrasse Tyson. And once again, we're getting sort of Cosmos 3.0 with Cosmos Possible Worlds on the National Geographic Channel. And there's a heck of a lot of stuff to chew into, both on history and science. And Mike Keyes is the perfect person to talk to about this. So, Mike, thanks for joining me again.
Oh, thanks, Jay. It's going to be fun.
Yeah, definitely. Well, of course, as we talked in a couple of previous episodes, which I recommend to listeners that haven't heard that, we spent a lot of time talking about both the anti-religious bias of this series and also its strangely religious overtones, its strangely kind of pantheistic overtones, and that's continued in the next episode. So let's just start with episode 3 this time, which is actually called The Lost City of Life. How does this episode begin? That is, what is this lost city and what are we supposed to learn from there?
Well, we hop onto the ship of the imagination and plunge into the ancient oceans of Earth. And we find at the bottom of the ocean these hydrothermal vents where we have these things that look like smokestacks. Some of them are black, some of them are white, and some of them are up to 18 stories high. It looks like a city with smokestacks. So how's that for a nice play on words? Because he has some comments to make about the origin of life here.
Okay, so is that the point? Is that why we start here? Is this kind of speculative idea that maybe the first forms of life developed in these hydrothermal vents deep under the sea?
Right. And so hydrothermal vents are where you have significant tectonic activity, like on the edges of plates, and water is going down into the interior of the earth. It heats up, and then it just bursts out, and it's full of minerals that then give you the cool colors and effects, as well as a really interesting ecological niche for some unusual forms of life. So, yeah, that's the scene of the crime, if you will. And there's some interesting points he makes as he takes you to the ocean's bottom.
Well, so, what's the basic argument that he makes? I mean, of course, you and I know this is a sort of widespread discussion, but for a general audience, TV series like this, I mean, what's the point of starting in this one place?
Well, here's some quotations from Tyson. It takes energy to make life, and we find it in the bottom of the ocean. Well, it's true. You do have this chemical energy generated by these processes that I just described. And he then says, well, longer and more complex molecules were generated in this part of the world, or likely did. And then he says the spark of energy that built the first life is this, you know, geochemical energy, you know, the temperature and the different chemicals that are produced here. He imagines that somehow molecules became longer and then somehow life form. But of course, the details are absent as to how that could happen. But that's the story. In fact, here's another quote. What you have just seen, when he finishes this sequence, is the most plausible scientific creation myth that we have today about the origin of life. And so he says, what he really means, Jay, is, of course, the most plausible materialistic creation myth.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny that he actually uses the term myth there, I guess, in this sort of broadest sense. But, I mean, what's the point? I mean, obviously, the surface of the planet also has a heck of a lot of energy as well. There's, you know, there's heat and chemical energy in these thermal vents. There's also a lot of solar energy up on the top. I mean, is there something that this is supposed to solve, some problem with the origin of life that is sort of uniquely solved by putting it down here on the bottom of the ocean?
Well, it's widely believed that the early Earth was largely a water world. And so if you track the first appearance of life back, that's where it would have to occur, or it would have to occur somewhere on an Earth that was largely covered by water. So given that this is at least some form of energy that could drive some chemical reactions, it's at least something you could hold on to if you believe that life came from non-life without intelligent guidance.
Okay, so yeah, so it sort of makes sense, assuming one, that the early Earth was a water world, you're going to need it to take place in the water, obviously enough, and then assuming that somehow, merely from the laws of physics, chemistry, plus sort of time and chance, you're going to pass over this chasm from the world of chemistry to the world of biology. And then given this kind of assumption of materialism, then you say something like this must have happened. And so we need a story. We can call it a myth, but we still need one. And Tyson is in some ways admitting this is kind of the best one at the moment that we've come up with, even though he himself sort of concedes that it's still at the level of mythology. I mean, is that sort of his glancing way of saying, okay, look, we don't have a lot of details, admittedly, but it's the best story we have?
Yeah. I mean, he does that, but the way that when you follow his story, he just moves on, and it's kind of like, well, here's, you sort of forget the caveats and you just move on with the story that somehow this must have happened, and here's a scenario that might describe it. But of course, the professional literature is full of doubts about this.
Yeah, I mean, give us some balance. I assume he did not give us a brief survey at this section in the episode about the serious problems with these chemical origin of life scenarios, right? But I mean, you know, give listeners some sense of the controversy and maybe a reference or two to balance the Cosmos episode.
Yeah, in a little essay we have up at Evolution News, one of our websites, there's a quote from an origin of life researcher, John Sutherland, who in an article called Studies on the Origin of Life, The End of the Beginning, he's just admitting that we really know very little about the origin of life, from how life could come from non-life by unguided material processes. But he does actually mention this hypothesis about these deep sea vents and says that one big problem among several is that for even materialists to think of some way of this happening, there would at least need to be enough ultraviolet light to generate hydrated electrons. And there's a list of other prerequisites beyond this, but he says, and it's quoted on our website, that this whole theory of life developing around deep sea vents should itself remain in the deep bosom of the ocean buried. In other words, it's not a very good theory.
And so this is even, I mean, this is quite apart from positive evidence for design. This is just purely in terms of the chemistry and the details. The hypothesis is left wanting. But of course, I know that Discovery Institute, I think, right, just recently re-released the Intelligent Design classic, The Mystery of Life's Origins, which is precisely about this, right?
Yeah, it's a great resource since it does update the argument. It's a classic text, but brings it up to speed. And this is in line with the kind of peer-reviewed literature that I just cited, which the one I cited, by the way, was from Nature Reviews Chemistry, which, of course, is a mainstream journal with a good reputation.
Yeah. So I don't want to sort of beat a dead horse here. The truth of the matter is, whatever story you want to come up with, you've got to somehow account for the origin of biological information. And it just seems that there's an in principle problem with getting from chemistry, whatever, however robust it is, to actually getting to biological information. But of course, the materialist, including Neil deGrasse Tyson, needs some sort of story. So this is maybe the best thing, that, at least the most visually compelling thing that we have at the moment. I can say that the hydrothermal vents are way more interesting to look at than the old Miller-Urey experiment diagrams, right? Those are just deadly boring. And at least they've got actual living things now when we're looking at these undersea vents. Well, let's move on. So just as the episode does. So we start on the bottom of the ocean at the beginning of the episode, and then it moves to Enceladus, which is this moon of Saturn. It's got these ice water geysers and subsurface ocean. And in your article at Evolution News, you say, okay, now we begin to see why Tyson sided with the embattled deep ocean vents scenario. So in some ways we're seeing, okay, initially you might think we're talking about just the origin of life on Earth, but then now we suddenly move to Enceladus, this moon of Saturn. So what exactly is happening here?
Yes. Well, two things. The sort of the visual similarity of these smokestack looking things spewing out mineral rich materials on Earth. And then on this moon, Enceladus, Cassini, when it went within, I think about 15 miles from the surface. That's like 15 Grand Canyons distances from the surface. That's pretty close. And they got great views of how these explosions of material from the surface of the iced over ocean on this moon that bursts out, and they were able to get some idea of what it was. And so you have the visual similarity of the two, and then you have the search for plausible locations within our solar system or beyond where there could be conditions that are life supporting. So of course you need water, you need some other criteria to all line up. And so this is one of the candidates. In fact, there's a mission, you know, another NASA project that will probably include Enceladus on its itinerary because of this interest that Cosmos is generating in it. Of course, scientists have been talking about this for a while, but this is now at the popular level, shows why it's an interesting place.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, if you're going to look someplace, there are moons around Jupiter and Saturn. I honestly think that none of these are especially good candidates for life for all sorts of reasons. But, you know, if you're going to look, better to look at someplace that has certain forms of energy and water and things like that, obviously, than just a barren rock. So given the choices, I can understand why NASA and Neil deGrasse Tyson would be interested in this particular moon. You say in your piece at Evolution News also that the episode touches on the Cambrian explosion, which listeners will know is that period of in life's history, a little over a half a billion years ago, in which the major animal body plans sort of appeared geologically all at once. It's a great unanswered question, obviously, for Darwinists. How does Tyson handle it in the episode?
Well, the way Tyson and others handle this is they'll cite one or more preconditions or necessary conditions for rapid appearance of new animal body plans, perhaps the first animal body plans in this case. And there have been a series of different proposals for what it is, you know. Well, and they'll mention just one of these and say, see, this is the key to the Cambrian explosion. But there's so many other things that would have to take place. And again, referring to the problem of the origin of new information that you described earlier, that's the one that always gets skipped over conveniently. Yeah. So yeah.
That's the big question. Sort of avoid that, hope no one notices it. But I mean, it's sort of fascinating logically. So the idea is that, well, so complex animal life forms need an oxygen-rich atmosphere. So therefore, if you have some oxygen in the atmosphere, then you'll get the animals. I mean, right. It's confusing a necessary condition for sufficient explanation, which, you know, smart people like this, these very people wouldn't make that logical mistake anywhere else. But I mean, this is the kind of metaphysical force that the materialist view has upon the mind that, look, you got to come up with something. And if that's the best we can do, then so be it. But I don't want to spend too much time on these nitty-gritty science things because, I mean, you're a science historian. I want to talk a little bit more before we run out of time about the historical details. And I know there's a glaring historical error in this episode. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, he spends a lot of time on the Herschels, William Herschel, father, John Herschel, the son, and also Caroline Herschel. And they were very prominent astronomers. William, the dad in this case, he discovered Uranus and his son. Right. Yeah. But Cosmos does not mention their Christian faith and how this shaped their thinking. So you skip over the parts that are inconvenient for the basic storyline that science, for it to progress, should avoid religion. That's what they want to push.
Yeah, and that does happen over and over again. I mean, I know that there's also, I think Gregor Mendel does get a mention, and he's the founder of genetics, and there's an Augustinian friar. And so it's a little more difficult because he's an actual religious, right? He's a friar. Right. How do they handle him?
Well, they show him in his religious garb to indicate his, you know, what he was about, but they don't go into how his specific theological orientation guided his work. And that's the case with many other characters in the history of science that are mentioned at best as well. It's either just described and not the significance is not made, or the religion is treated as a minor distraction to what they were really all about. And that's just not authentic to what these characters, as we look at them, you know, in their historical detail, they would not agree with that description. They took their religion very seriously. And you know, when you think about it, for a person who believes that there is a God who made a world that is intended to be understood, that encourages people, motivates them to try to figure out what are the laws that make nature work the way it works.
So this theological view, in other words, it's not incidental to these people. And so people like Tyson, I mean, he treats the religious beliefs of contemporary people as probably an impediment. And then in the case of these historical figures whose scientific credentials can't be doubted because they're part of the history of science, their religious beliefs, especially their Christian beliefs, tend to be treated just as incidental. And unfortunately, it sounds like that's what's happened here.
Yeah, yeah. And I've seen this done over and over in popular science writing. So it's kind of, oh yeah, that again.
Exactly. Well, I've been joined by Mike Keyes, and I didn't mention at the beginning, but his great recent book, Unbelievable: 7 Myths About the History and Future of Science and Religion, in which Mike goes into a lot more detail about these things and about the myths that we think we know about science and religion, and also the role of religious belief in the history of science. Mike, thanks for joining me.
You're welcome, Jay. It's been fun.
This is Jay Richards with Discovery Institute and ID the Future. Thanks so much for joining us.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.